On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. The Republican convention gets underway today in Cleveland. Liz Copeland, a Baltimore Republican who's the founder of the Urban Conservative Project, joins me for a preview. Then, what's the best way to end homelessness? Certain data suggest that providing homeless people permanent housing is the most effective strategy, but others argue that transitional housing combined with counseling, treatment, and training makes more sense. Jan Mitchell is a former resident of Marion House, which helped her achieve sobriety and success. Katie Alston is the director of Marion House, one of 19 transitional housing programs in Baltimore that are facing big budget cuts. We'll talk about what those cuts might portend for people facing housing insecurity. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick has a review of the Contemporary American Theater Festival. First, the news.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Hope you had a good weekend, and I'm glad you're with us this morning. As Republicans begin their convention in Cleveland and the official rollout of the Trump-Pence ticket, what are the implications of that ticket for down-ballot races here in Maryland and across the country? For months now, observers have described the brutal primary process as a battle for the soul of the Republican Party. Well, has that battle been won by Donald Trump? And how will Trump use the spotlight this week to launch his race against Hillary Clinton? We will address these and other questions on all three of our shows this week. On Friday, the morning after the convention ends, we'll get analysis from Richard Cross, who's working as a speechwriter at the convention, Chris Kafalas, who's a Republican candidate in the U.S. Senate primary race that was eventually won by Delegate Kathy Shalega, and Adar Aira of the Associated Black Charities and Baltimore Racial Justice Action. And on Wednesday, we'll be joined by Jenna Johnson, who has been covering the Trump campaign since last September for the Washington Post. And this morning, my guest is Liz Copeland, who is the president and founder of the Urban Conservative Project. Last April, she was a candidate in the Republican primary for the 1st District Baltimore City Council seat. She was part of a crowded field who lost to Matthew McDaniel, and he will face Democrat Zeke Cohen in November. Liz Copeland, it's a delight to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me on.
So many Maryland Republicans are not Trump supporters, and I take it that you're one of those. Trump won the primary here by 54%. His closest challenger was John Kasich, who got half that amount of the vote. I wonder, do you think that the Maryland Republican leadership is out of step with Republican voters here in Maryland, at least?
I know this is not what you want to hear, but I have no idea. And I'm not quite sure that anyone within or outside of the party really have a full understanding of what is happening. It's such an anomaly. In Maryland, like you said, Trump won 54%, but that was one of the largest percentage of the whole that he got in any of the states. On average, he didn't get more than 36, 34% of the vote in any other states prior to Maryland. I think in Maryland, what you saw is many people getting behind a winner. They saw that Donald Trump was out in the head. Kasich was not pulling up. He wasn't bringing up any steam. Rubio had dropped out. Bush had dropped out. Carson had dropped out. Maryland was a strong Carson state. And many of the Republicans decided that, you know, this is the guy who's going to win. Let me get in and support him. As far as the party is concerned, I think oftentimes people are surprised at how the Republican Party isn't as hierarchical as possibly the Democratic Party. It's really a bottom up. You know, the leaders follow the frontline activists, the frontline troops, and what they want.
It seems that there's a lot of the Trump platform, the little we know of it, because he's been a little unspecific on a lot of
issues. As in
issues.
Nothing. We have no idea other than build a wall and make us great.
Yeah. But for example, he's anti-trade, and the Republican Party is traditionally a free trade party. He wants to keep Social Security and Medicare mostly as they are. As far as we know, others are, you know, very much in favor of revising and realigning entitlements. He's talked about America's role in the world in a way that's in opposition to certainly the Bush administration and other Republican leaders like Senator McCain. There's a lot that doesn't line up with this sort of quote-unquote traditional Republican platform. How do you reckon that? What do you think that's going to mean for this convention and for this campaign?
I think it's a reflection of what the party leaders on a national level, they made a mistake in doing. They didn't realize that many of middle America, middle class, white men and women who were either middle class or working class, and after the recession, they saw the Republican Party still talking about the establishment issues. They were talking about how we were to support free enterprise, but also support the job creators, which really means tax breaks for those of the top tier. They saw their manufacturing jobs being closed down and them being outsourced to other countries, and no one was listening. And so this is a reaction to what I believe many in our party realized, that our government wasn't working for us. The Republican Party still talked about how we were going to close or we should change the way Medicare is operated. But, you know, that's not an issue that's supported by many working class within the party. They want Medicare. They want that entitlement. So reducing entitlements, strengthening trade the way it is written, and having our foreign policy as written now, it's not something that people who grew up in this country feel was the right direction to go, because they felt that, one, they lost their jobs, they lost their money, and there was a decrease in pride, and they were upset. And I can understand that completely.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Liz Copeland. She's the president and founder of the Urban Conservative Project. It used to be that folks talked about conservative Republicans, moderate Republicans. But for a while, conservative and Republican were kind of equivalent terms. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's still the case?
No, I don't. As an urban conservative, I would be what most people consider right of center. I'm a moderate Republican, a Rockefeller Republican. I believe that our social issues are decided law. I support marriage equality. I support a woman's right to choose what to do with her body. And anyone who calls himself a conservative and believes in upholding individual rights and liberties should have the same position. Period. And there are many still within the Republican Party who agree with me, but we are a minority, and it's time for the minority to push back on far, far right political ideology and to stand up to the establishment that has accepted individuals like Donald Trump to come in with such statements of bigotry, xenophobia, and say that that's not what our party is about. And if we don't do it, then someone else will continue to define conservatism.
Is the time to make those statements and to do that step up now?
Absolutely.
Right before he's going to be nominated as the Republican standard bearer?
So,
or is it too late?
This is, of course, a reactionary proposal. It is too late. Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for this election cycle. And there are many people who have given up on the presidential election. My theory is that you're going to see in these races, when you look at the election results, many people either not show up to the polls, or you'll see more votes cast for the Senate and down ballot than for the president. And I think that's a reflection of how people just, as a Republican, I'm never Trumper, but I'm not with her. And I'll either write in someone or vote for Gary Johnson. I'm not at a point where I've been able to decide. And there's still a lot of people who don't know what to do. We really don't know what to do.
Mr. Trump has been called a racist demagogue by people in his own party.
Yes.
The Republican leadership has used that terminology, and Republican commentators, et cetera. Is there something that Mr. Trump can do this week to prove that he's as inclusive as he says he is?
Yeah, one would hope. You know, I am not a psychologist. I don't have a DSM-5. I think Mr. Trump is a narcissist. I think that he could, but he won't. You just look at how he unveiled his vice presidential pick, and he spent 40 minutes talking about how great he was. And it just was a misstep and just very reflective of the individual that we have and the character of our nominee.
What do you think the implications, you talked about how a lot of folks, perhaps yourself included, may just skip the presidential race, but still be very involved and vote down ballot. How do you think this is going to affect, for example, the race that Kathy Shalega faces against Chris Van Hollen for the Senate seat being vacated by Barbara Mikulski?
For full disclosure, I am a supporter of Kathy Shalega. I think that she would be a wonderful asset to the Senate. I know this is a tough race for her, but I think she made the right step by not going to the convention. I think our governor made the right choice. And I think when we look back, we'll see that they're on the right side of history, that they did not align themselves with the statements and the behavior of our nominee. I think that her race is going to be tough. It's going to be really tough. Chris Van Hollen has a plethora of policy experience. He knows how to get things done. And it's still a 2-to-1 Democratic advantage in the state of Maryland. But Kathy Shalega has a story that resonates with a lot of Marylanders, Democrats included, just, you know, working hard, being there for the average Marylander, and I think that's going to help her.
Do you think it's going to hurt her that 54% of Republicans who voted in the primary voted for Mr. Trump? And if she's distancing herself from Donald Trump, is that going to, you know, is she going to lose her base?
It's possible. I don't think it's going to be detrimental to her campaign or the election outcome. I think that at the end of the day, she hasn't came out and spoken. She hasn't said what Liz says. I'm a never Trumper. And it's everywhere on social media. I'm clear with where I am with our Republican nominee. She hasn't done that. I think that's smart.
Folks have talked about how this is the year of the outsider. That, you know, it's people, the grassroots movement in the Republican Party is, in fact, what's taken over the Republican Party. I mean, you talk about the Urban Conservative Project as being a grassroots movement. There are folks who would point to the current situation as being grassroots, you know, upending the wishes of the party elite, the party leaders heretofore. Is this a year of the outsider? I mean, have the outsiders come up with the answers, you know, that they're simply, as it were, trumped the
right
answers of the leadership.
What a great play on words. I don't believe they have. I think what they attempted to disrupt it. Well, I think they attempted to make some changes, but what they've accomplished is a disruption. And that's the beginning. The outsiders have clearly shown that there is dissatisfaction within the party. But it's not, you know, specific or just only within the Republican Party. You look at Bernie Sanders and his success. I mean, you have someone who was an independent, and caucus with the Democrats and considered himself a socialist. He pulled a party, their party, further to the left. I mean, you're seeing that pattern of behavior of people tired of the status quo and business as usual. As an urban conservative, I know most people believe that statement is reflective of minorities, black or brown people. But it's really about individuals living in the city and how urban conservatives are socially progressive but fiscally conservative and they want government to work. I think across the board, if you have activists who want to see the party return to its conservative values, Donald Trump is not conservative. He doesn't have conservative values. I think that you may see a realignment of both sides, even the Tea Partiers with urban conservatives and some of the Trumpers.
Well, it's been a delight to talk to you. Thank you so much, and I look forward to having you back.
Appreciate Thank you.
It. Liz Copeland is the president and founder of the Urban Conservative Project. She was a candidate in the Republican primary for the first district Baltimore City Council seat last April. That race was won by Matthew McDaniel, who will face Democrat Zeke Cohen in November. Stay tuned to WYPR for complete coverage of both the Republican and Democratic conventions. It begins at 8 o'clock tonight here on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, a challenge for agencies who provide traditional housing. We'll learn about the work of Marion House and how shifting priorities are resulting in budget cuts for it and many other local organizations. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now we're going to focus on funding cuts that have left many homeless assistance programs scrambling. In May, the Department of Housing and Urban Development decided to discontinue grants to 19 of 21 Baltimore-based homeless services providers. The cuts are part of an overall move by HUD to shift support away from transitional housing towards permanent housing solutions. HUD estimates that there are about 2,500 people experiencing homelessness in Baltimore. Advocates for the homeless say that number could go up if service providers are forced to close their doors. Marion House is one of those 19 programs that's been affected by these cuts. In addition to providing shelter, the Transitional Housing Program offers rehabilitation services, life skills training, job readiness, and employment assistance to women and children who are experiencing homelessness. Katie Alston is the executive director of Marion House. Jan Mitchell is an alumna of the program, and they both join me in the studio. Good morning. It's good to see you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Katie, tell us a little bit about Marion House and what transitional housing means.
Sure. Marion House was opened in 1982. Actually, at the time, our focus was to serve women who were coming out of incarceration, to be a safe place for women who were being discharged from jail in here in the city and needed a safe place to go so that they could redirect their lives to positive living. And over the years, we've grown, we've expanded into families, and our primary focus has become more on women who are experiencing homelessness, as well as having a myriad of other issues, such as mental health problems, substance abuse issues, etc. And we've created in our transitional program a really robust services program that includes individual therapy, group therapy, to help the women that we're serving really address the core causes of their homelessness and their difficult life situations. And our goal is for every woman who comes through the program to become employed, to really, you know, come back to society and become a real active member of their community and their society. And that when they leave us, they'll be able to succeed long term.
Mm-hmm. So permanent housing is certainly a goal eventually,
but
it's not the goal initially, right?
Yes, and we do have permanent housing as well. We've grown into not just having that main shelter, but also having a permanent housing component. We used to be able to move women kind of through the different stages of the program. But the Transitional Housing Program for Single Women is our core program that we opened almost 35 years ago.
Yeah. And Jan Mitchell, what was your situation and your experience as part of the Transitional Housing Program at Marion House?
I started late in life, you know, with regard to a drug addiction or whatever, which started with pain pills and, you know, physical issues. So I found myself homeless at the age of 46. Now, having been out there with other addicts, we all hung together. We all, you know, went up and down the avenue trying to do whatever it was that we could do to get money to get our drugs. So I found my way to the Marion House through another smaller program. And my experience since I've been there, it's exactly what I needed. I needed long-term, I needed something with structure, and I needed to deal with my issues. Drug addiction, you know, I have some trauma issues that I've dealt with. And the Marion House program has afforded me the time that I need, because this is a full-time job. Getting yourself together is a full-time job, whether it be mental illness or whether it would be a drug addiction, spousal abuse. There's not almost anything that you can talk about that I haven't been through. And through my experience with Marion House, a lot of the programs are right there in the house. So I didn't have to go out, you know, and run and do all that with regard to getting my recovery. It was right there in the house.
And so that's a big very important parameter of this. It's not like you have to find services in five or six different places.
Right. We did eventually go out to receive other help, but having it right there in the house, I needed myself a safe haven. After being out on the street and seeing the things and experiencing the things that I did, I needed to feel safe. I needed to know that I had a place to rest my head at night. So the Marion House, oh my gosh, I can't even say enough about it. From the moment that I walked in the door, I felt safe and I felt loved and I felt respected. You know, when you're out on the street, you don't have much of, you know, I didn't care about myself. I didn't think highly of myself. I felt unloved and unworthy. So when I came into the Marion House, and Miss Katie is one of the fresh faces that I saw, who always made me feel wanted, loved, and respected.
How long have you been sober?
It'll be actually 2 years on the 24th of July this month.
God bless.
Thank you. I'm really excited.
Congratulations.
I couldn't stay clean and sober for 2 days, let alone 2 years.
Yeah, that's great.
So, that's great.
Mm-hmm. Katie Alston, where does your funding come from? Is it majority federal or state or city or private donations? And what big a hit are you taking financially because of HUD's decision to withdraw funding this year?
You name it, that's where we get our money from, all those things that you mentioned. We do have a diverse funding stream, actually. It's one of the reasons that we are confident that we'll be able to weather the storm that is a funding cut of this size. It was over a little over $200,000 that we lost to the program. So certainly that is, I mean, for our total organization budget is just under $3 million, although about half of it is going to our permanent housing program. So it is about 15% of our transitional housing budget. It does mean we need to hit the pavement now more to replace those funds. But we have multiple government grants. Some are state, some are federal monies, but then we also, you know, do everything from sending appeals. We have our 5K, which is our annual fundraiser on September 24th over at Lake Montebello.
Do you think that you'll be able to replace these funds, or will this have an impact that will result in some of your programs being cut back or closed even?
Right now, we're committed to doing the work that it will take to replace the funds. If you ask me in a couple of years, perhaps I will have a different answer, but we have a handful of ideas in place that I, unfortunately, I'm not at liberty to speak to, but certainly some of it is to our private donors, foundations, not long-term, but some of the foundations have at least been kind to say that they'll help us in the interim until we have a longer-term plan. And, you know, the organization has a capacity to ask people for money, to go out and visit. There are, unfortunately, some organizations that lost their grant, and their grant was their entire operating budget. And they have no fundraising
staff. So they're
out
of business. Yeah.
So they are shutting their doors.
That's Katie Alston. She is the director of Marion House here in Baltimore. Jan Mitchell joins us in the studio as well. She's an alumna of the program. Katie and Jan, I want to play for you a part of a conversation that our producer Bridget Armstrong had the other day with Brian Sullivan. He's with HUD, and he's explaining the way that HUD has prioritized their grant giving, which, as we say, is more towards permanent housing. A lot of studies have been done saying that a better solution to homelessness is giving people permanent housing right from the get-go rather than going from transitional to permanent housing. Here's what Mr. Sullivan had to say.
In 2010, when this administration launched a really rather bold strategy to end homelessness, as we've come to know it in this country, that strategy is built on the idea that it's no longer enough to simply manage homelessness. We've got to end it. There is a national movement taking place, and HUD is very much leading this movement. We've found that if you want to end homelessness, the best approach is to connect individuals and families with permanent housing solutions. Those who experience homelessness tend to remain homeless for far too long, and there's a kind of revolving door where individuals are coming in and out of homelessness all the time. Today, we know what works, and quite honestly, we've challenged local planners to move in a different direction. In this year's competition, we told our applicants that this year was going to be our most competitive year ever by reserving 15% of our grants going to the best of the best projects. This year, the competition was so intense that we saw some cities receive significantly more funding and others that saw less funding year over year. We saw New York City, Philadelphia, Houston, Seattle, Portland, Baltimore County see increased funding. Other communities like the city of Baltimore saw less funding year over year. And to be honest, the federal government and local communities are moving away from some of the higher cost, less effective interventions. I think we can all agree that we must invest taxpayer dollars wisely and in practices that have proven to work. Now, that is not to say that any one approach is proven not to work or that some are better than others, but I will say that while transitional housing can be an important tool in managing homelessness, we have been encouraging communities to offer permanent, more lasting housing solutions to an even greater number of persons and families who are experiencing homelessness.
That's Brian Sullivan. He is in the Public Affairs Department of Department of Housing and Urban Development. So, Jan Mitchell, what's your response to that? Because you were part of the transitional housing program at the Marion House, do you think your problems would have been alleviated and you would have been able to deal with the issues you were facing had somebody just simply given you a key to an apartment?
Oh, my goodness. That's like putting the cart before the horse. I find that doing it that way is not what's going to work. I've been out there. I've seen the people who are homeless. I've spoken. I've lived with them. And I can say the majority of the people have either a drug addiction or a mental illness. I think what we have to do in order to really cut this homelessness out is to have more places like the Marion House, have more recovery programs, because the majority of the people out there have an addiction. If I was just handed a key, and I feel very comfortable saying that if any of the other people out there were just handed a key, you would find a whole lot more crack houses, shooting galleries, prostitution places, because that would be a place for, if I was given the key and I was still in active addiction, I would be making money and drugs hand over fist. Come on over to my place. I have a safe place for you to come. You can shoot your drugs. All you have to do is give me a cut. That's how I believe if you talk to the people on the street, that is going to be their response, because we need help with our addiction and our mental illness issues. Right. And having a place like the Marion House where we have rules and we have structure to know that if we don't do this, I might not have a place to lay my head at night. That gives me a goal to reach. And when I get to that goal, it's something else.
So, Katie, there's two issues. There's what works. Mm-hmm. And there's, as I said, a large body of data that says that permanent housing actually does work. And there are scholars who would tell you it works better than transitional housing. And then there's the paucity of funds. I mean, HUD has a limited amount of money, and they've got to decide who they're giving that money to. Setting aside what works, when it comes to the issue of how to allocate these funds from HUD, I mean, what's your response to what Mr. Sullivan is saying? Because he's basically saying there's a limited amount of money, we had to choose, and so we've chosen the permanent housing way based on the data.
I think it's short-sighted. I think that people need somewhere to stay short-term. The permanent housing doesn't happen overnight. You have to apply. You have to get your documents in order. You need to find a unit once you're approved for that permanent housing. The unit has to be inspected. Where are people going to stay in the interim? I very much want there to be more investment in permanent housing. I don't want there to be more investment in permanent housing because we've de-invested in something else that is still very much needed in our communities. And I think that, you know, what Jan said, there are many other people like Jan for whom a place like Marion House is the best choice. There are people for whom that don't need Marion House. They don't need a program like ours. They do simply need an apartment. They're down on their luck. They've lost a job, you know, whatever the situation may be.
That's part of what Mr. Sullivan is saying, that, you know, the wraparound services that you provide, the counseling and whatnot, is very expensive, obviously. And, you know, if there are people who don't need that, then they're spending money that they don't need to spend.
We wouldn't admit someone into our program who doesn't need our program. I think that most programs like Marion House that exist in the country would probably say the same. We don't just open the door and, you know, whoever is in need, even if you don't need the services we provide, we would say we're not the most appropriate service provider for you. So we're not wasting money.
And you do transition people out of the transitional housing into permanent housing, right?
Yes, although the problem now is other related HUD changes. There's a coordinated access system in all the cities across the country that has to identify the most vulnerable person for permanent housing openings. So that means someone like Jan, who took the time to get herself well and get back on her feet, is not going to actually be able to avail the permanent housing solutions anymore, even though she is on a limited disability income.
Jan wouldn't be able to avail herself of that because there are people in more dire need than she
right.
is. But even though Jan has gotten herself together here,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
so you're lower on the ladder of
exactly.
dire need. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
that's a catch-22, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And again, I'm a social worker. I want no one sleeping on a park bench. I want no one sleeping under the Falls Way. And if what they want is an apartment, if that's the best thing for them, I absolutely want that to be available mm-hmm. for them. I really want housing choice. I want the people who are in need in our city to be able to avail the service that they think is best for them. And for Jan, she would have said, I need Marion House. I need what they have to offer.
Right. So are you in transitional housing now then,
Jan? No, actually, and to come behind what Miss Katie just said, it's not to say that I couldn't have gotten long-term housing. I am overscale because, you know, I am on Social Security disability. And I also am working after 10 years of not working. I never thought that I would work again. I've kind of gone back to my family and, you know, I'm living under the same roof as my daughter. I have a small apartment there, which is perfect. However, I would have been able to, if I wanted to, get into some kind of permanent housing through the Marion House. It was just that I decided to make another choice. I live in Anne Arundel County. That's where I'm from. And I'm back together with all the help that I've had. I actually am living under the same roof as a child who once put me out of the house. So,
Well, I'm glad that for that as well, that you know, reconciled with her.
Yes.
So, Katie, what should be the criteria? How do we strike the balance? How should HUD strike the balance in terms of how they're allocating funds?
Well, at this point, there's only one transitional housing program in the entire city of Baltimore that's being funded by HUD. Every other program got cut.
There are 21 programs overall
that are transitional.
Right, and 19 of them got cut.
So I think we might be beyond being able to strike a balance, sadly. The new application for funding, they are not entertaining new applications for transitional housing. The only application that you can submit for a new project to be funded is permanent housing. I would argue, though, that no one, I believe, is actually studying the effectiveness of transitional housing. They are studying this new model of straight from the street to permanent housing because it's a new model. And again, one that I want to have in our city, absolutely. But they're not studying that and then also coming around to our transitional housing programs and studying us. They aren't. So, and you know, I think that's one of the problems in our world, organizations like mine, we're busy doing our work. We don't have the capacity to do research, you know, in a true way. I mean, we have numbers. We have exit numbers. We know Jan and all the other people who came after her. Did they go to permanent housing when they left? Did they have a job? We have information, don't get me wrong, but it's very hard to do real research in the way that HUD would expect it to be done.
So you're questioning some of this data. I mean, when people are saying that the permanent housing is the panacea, it may be not. Yeah.
Is it balanced?
Yeah. Well, it's a very important issue, and it's a very important decision that we need to make, you know, in terms of public policy. So I appreciate both of you coming and shedding light. And Jan Mitchell, congratulations
to you.
Thank you. Things are going so well.
It's really nice to have all my thoughts together. I have a job and a car and a place to live and money in the bank. And so, and that is only because of the Marion House.
No, you did a lot of hard work.
I did do a lot of hard work.
God bless you both.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Katie Alston is the executive director of Marion House, a transitional housing and rehabilitation program for homeless women and children. And Jan Mitchell is an alumna of that program. If you'd like to support the work of Marion House, their annual Independence 5K walk and run is on September 24th. We've got more information at wipr.org/Marilyn Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, we'll check in with theater critic J. Wynn Russick. She's been to the Contemporary American Theater Festival, and we'll see what she found there. It's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We are at Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Marilyn Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Also glad to welcome back to the studio, as we do every Monday morning, our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. Hey, Judy, how you doing?
Fine, thank you, Tom.
Good. So you have been to the Contemporary American Theater Festival, which is over in Shepherdstown, West Virginia, at Shepherd University. They've been around for 26 years, and you've gone to at least more than 20 of them, right?
So you've
been making the schlep out there. This is, as I say, in its 26th season. You get five new plays, and they're all staged in this rotating repertory, right? So I understand that this year the lineup has a very distinctive feature. What's that?
Well, Tom, as you are well aware, there has been an emphasis this season in theaters across the country in producing plays written by women. And the Contemporary American Theater Festival has always been strong in this respect. However, this year, four out of the five plays are by women. And women often create strong roles for women, and that is definitely true this summer. The most powerful role of all the plays is in Alison Gregory's play Not Medea, and it also receives the festival's best performance by an actress named Joey Parsons. Her character starts out as a late arriver at the theater. She's a theater goer, but she's as rude as can be. She chatters away at us. She takes cell phone calls. She has brought her dinner to eat during the play.
I have sat next to her.
Yeah, I'm sure. We learn that she's a mother, and she's taking the night off, and she's rather upset to discover that the play she's come to see is Medea. And then, in sort of Pirandello fashion, she winds up on stage playing Medea. And the theatergoer's story, her story, becomes so entwined with Medea's story that sometimes you can't tell which is a good thing. It's very challenging. It's a fascinating, frightening piece of meta theater. I'd love to see it again.
So this is great. I mean, there was a whole couple of festivals of just female playwrights right here in Baltimore in the last couple of years. And I know there's a big one in L.A. every year. There's a big one in Chicago. So with the preponderance of all these female playwrights, which I'm all for, are most of the roles in all these plays, most of them female?
Well, no, but the central characters are mostly female. There's a play called Penmanship by Christina Anderson, and it only has one female role, but she's the pivotal character. She's an African-American woman named Ruby, and she is the only woman on a rundown ship that is heading to Liberia in 1896. It's a rather mysterious voyage. The man in charge is an African-American land surveyor. He's a very religious man. He's traveling with his son, and it's his son who has brought Ruby on board. I brought you actress Margaret Ivey as Ruby talking to one of the ship's crewmen, and you can hear the fortitude and the power in her voice.
Ignorance angers me, Cecil. And Mr. Charles and Jacob Boyd expect me to fall silent in the face of their ignorance, but I am under no one's control.
Why do you consider them ignorant?
Those men submit to a belief system designed to disable progress among our people. What good has Christian belief served to coloreds in America? The world!
That's a scene from Penmanship. It's one of the plays at the Contemporary American Theater Festival over in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. So, Judy, it's interesting. That play and the other one you described, Not Medea, seem incredibly different from each other. I mean, do the plays in this festival this summer, do they have common themes at all?
Well, actually, both of those plays are somewhat about parents and children, and that crops up in some of the other plays, too, though to a lesser degree. The theme of slavery and bondage shows up in two of the plays. I have to say that Ed Herendeen, the festival's producing director, always says he doesn't look for common themes or subjects or styles. But besides the themes I've already mentioned, two of the plays are written in response to classics, Not Medea, obviously, response to Euripides. There's another play called The Second Girl by Ronan Noon, and it's a response to a modern American classic, Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey Into Night. It's kind of an upstairs-downstairs look at O'Neill's semi-autobiographical play. It focuses on the three servants in Long Day's Journey, Tyrone family's chauffeur, their Irish cook, and the cook's niece, Kathleen, the second girl, who has recently arrived from Ireland. It's a very interesting concept, but it's kind of tough to compete with one of the greatest plays in American literature.
Yeah, a tall order.
It took on a lot. I found it sort of less far-reaching and kind of smaller than O'Neill's drama, which is really an epic. You won't be surprised to know that alcoholism crops up downstairs as well as upstairs, and I brought a clip. This is the chauffeur played by Ted Coach, and he is discussing the cook's alcohol problem with her niece, played by Catherine Wake.
She was on the ground last night.
Bridget.
Outside my door.
Drunk.
She's embarrassed about it.
How did you get her in the house?
Carried her.
I don't know what you see in her when she's like that.
So that's Ted Coach and Catherine Wake in Ronan Noon's play at the Shepherdstown Festival, Contemporary American Theater Festival. That's The Second Girl. By the way, is Ronan Noon a female playwright as well?
No, that's the one male in the group.
Okay, I wonder because I didn't recognize that name as a female. And my full disclosure about my affinity for female playwrights is that my daughter is one. So, you know, we all have our crosses to bear, and that's one of mine. But but these two plays, I mean, the Second Girl and even Not Medea, I guess, Penmanship, they seem like pretty serious dramas. I mean, are there any funny ones this time?
Well, the closest this year...
For the shallow people in the audience like me?
The closest this year is a play by Susan Miller called 20th Century Blues. It focuses on four longtime female friends in their 60s, and the protagonist is a photographer, and she gets this group together once a year and takes their picture. I found that structure and that situation a little bit too pat, but there is a lot of humor. It's probably also the most commercial one of the plays.
Mm-hmm. And the Contemporary American Theater Festival has a very good track record, actually, for choosing plays that go on to be produced at other theaters. Do you think that this will happen with some of these plays that you saw this year?
Well, I hope that it'll happen with all the ones we've just discussed. There's really only one play this summer whose future looks doubtful to me. It's a play called The Wedding Gift. Very ordinary sounding title, but it's a really bizarre play. The playwright Chisa Hutchinson created her own language for this futuristic play. It's about an ordinary guy who suddenly finds himself the wedding gift, kind of a pet, or more accurately, a slave in a futuristic society. And he can't understand anything that's being said or anything that's going on. There's one scene that turns into kind of a game of charades where he's trying to figure these things out. Really, the whole play is kind of like that for the audience. It got a wonderful physical production at Shepherdstown, especially the costumes. But because of the language issue, it's short on depth and it's short on character development. I mean, you're just trying to keep up. Let's listen to some of that language.
Yeah,
I don't understand what you're saying.
Hade.
Hade. Stay, right? You want to stay here? Okay.
Ah, presh. Win na. Wan a. Na hade win.
No staying here.
Wan.
That's a tall order for an actor.
It's
one thing that you can learn a different language, but to have to learn, you know, syllable by syllable, a brand new language. Well, it sounds like, you know, there are some really good things worth checking out over in West Virginia. And Jay Wynn Russick, always good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Good to be here.
The Contemporary American Theater Festival continues through the 31st of the month, July. It's up in Shepherdstown, or I should say over in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. We'll have complete information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Stay tuned to WIPR for breaking news. We expect verdicts in the trial of Lieutenant Brian Rice very shortly. Judge Williams has said that he will issue his verdicts at 10 o'clock, and we will bring you those verdicts as soon as Judge Barry Williams announces his decision from Courthouse East in downtown Baltimore. And today at noon, Sheila Cast will have more on the verdicts on midday. Then coming up Wednesday here on Maryland Morning, we'll have more legal analysis with Edward Smith and David Jaros. We'll also have a report from the Republican Convention with Washington Post reporter Jenna Johnson. And we'll visit with our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day, and we'll see you in a few minutes when the verdict from the trial of Lieutenant Brian Rice is announced.